Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about domestic politics, as it pertains to interstate conflict. Specifically, we're going to discuss various interpretations of the correlation between joint democracy and peace. When I say there is a correlation between joint democracy and peace, I'm referring to a characteristic of a dyad, of a pair of states. Democracy is a country-level characteristic. If a country selects its leaders using free and fair elections, most of us would call that country democratic. If two countries both meet this standard, then the label of joint democracy would apply to them as a dyad. So US-UK is a jointly democratic dyad, but UK-North Korea is not. There's no need to talk about what exactly constitutes democracy here. There are many different definitions out there, but no matter which one you go by, you're going to find more or less the same pattern. It's possible that you'd conclude there's never been a war between two democracies, and it's possible that you could name a few that technically qualify as such. But either way, you'll conclude that conflict of any severity is less likely when both sides are democratic than if at least one of them is not. The debate isn't about whether a pattern exists. It's over what that pattern means, whether it reflects a causal relationship. Some say it does. I myself am a skeptic, though, and I'm going to try to convince you that you should be too. First, I'm going to identify serious flaws in two of the most prominent explanations for how democracy itself might produce this pattern. Then I'm going to present an alternative view, which basically amounts to identifying a plausible Z, a third factor that appears to be causally responsible for both whether states come into conflict in the first place and the type of governments they're going to have. After briefly summarizing the argument, I'll show you the results of some statistical analysis. I should say at this point that the two arguments I'm about to critique are not the only ones that suggest a causal interpretation of the correlation between joint democracy and peace. They are amongst the most prominent, though, and the others have flaws of their own. The following discussion should be sufficient, then, to convince you that anyone who claims that we could achieve world peace if the world was full of democracies, if every dyad was jointly democratic because all forms of authoritarianism had been defeated, has a lot more work to do. There are people who make that claim, and they might even be right. I tend to doubt it, but I can't claim to know for sure. What I can claim is that the arguments they've put forward so far don't hold up. If nothing else, we need a more sophisticated defense of the democratic peace. Okay, turn to the second slide. There, you'll find a table that poses a strong challenge to the first causal interpretation of the democratic peace. One reason people have argued that democracies are unlikely to fight one another is that democratic leaders are more accountable to the public across the board. They're more likely to be punished if they fail to deliver peace, prosperity, high-speed internet, and all manner of good things. So if the leaders of such regimes do choose to go to war, according to this view, they dang well better win, because otherwise they're going to be thrown out of office. And since they know that a military defeat will be followed by an electoral one, they refuse to go to war in the first place unless they're sure they can win. That doesn't stop them from waging war on autocracies. That's a fancy word for authoritarian regimes, especially weak ones that nonetheless pose a threat to their interests or those of the region. But it does stop them from going to war against one another. In other words, this argument basically says that democratic leaders are like poker players who fold just about every hand, waiting until they get a really strong one. If one Democrat sees another push their chips forward, they've got to think long and hard about whether to call that bet. An autocrat, on the other hand, allegedly doesn't need to do so. Nor do Democrats get spooked by bets that come from autocrats, since they assume these are bluffs. That, in a nutshell, is one of the most popular explanations for why democracies don't fight each other. And it's got a lot going for it. It does make a certain amount of sense, and one of the things we'd expect to see if it was true does in fact appear to be so. Namely, there's at least some evidence of a statistically significant pattern of association between regime type and war outcome. That democracies win wars while autocracies lose them, generally speaking. This too has been the matter of some debate, but we don't need to get into that for now, because there's a bigger problem with this argument. The table before you reports the percentage of democratic leaders in the middle two columns, and autocratic leaders in the two columns on the right, who experienced each of two different fates after a war. And what it's telling us is that roughly 30% of Democrats lose power after winning a war, usually because the economy's not doing so well and voters demand both peace and prosperity, whereas only 20% of autocratic leaders do. And those numbers jump to 90% and 50%, respectively, after a defeat. So democratic leaders always have a more tenuous hold on power, but their odds of remaining in office do depend a great deal on the outcome of the war. The difference between 90% and 30% is huge, much bigger than the difference between 20% and 50%, though the latter is not exactly trivial. So, that's in line with the argument I'm critiquing. The problem is that this isn't the only relevant consideration. Let's look at the other columns. The percentage of outgoing Democratic leaders who were punished, as in exiled, jailed, or murdered, after winning a war, is about 10%, compared to 40% for autocratic leaders. What about outgoing leaders who recently lost a war? Even then, only about 45% of democratic leaders are punished. For autocrats, though, the corresponding figure is roughly 90%. In other words, all democratic leaders need to worry about if they start a war and go on to lose is that they'll be voted out of office. At which point, they'll be treated like a dignified, if slightly disgraced, controversial, divisive, elder statesman. They'll go on book tours, play golf, start a charitable foundation, and so on. That's not as good as remaining in power, of course, but it sure beats a bullet in the head, which is exactly what autocrats fear will happen to them if they lose a war. Sure, there's a chance they'll remain in power, but it's far from certain. Not a whole lot better than a coin toss. And if they don't, they're in serious trouble. Put simply, there is no good reason to believe that democratic leaders have more to fear from losing a war. The second argument focuses on norms. The claim here is that democratic societies instill certain values in their citizens, all their citizens, even the elites. Thus, democratic leaders will think it's important, wherever possible, to resolve their disagreements peacefully, and to respect certain rights of the other side along the way. Moreover, we're to believe that they externalize these norms, that is, apply the rules that govern their actions domestically to their behavior internationally. Again, this view acknowledges that democracies sometimes go to war with non-democracies, but its proponents argue that they only do so when they must, when their values require them to protect those whose right to self-determination is being violated by despots who can't be relied upon to solve their disagreements peacefully. When forces like Nazism, Soviet communism, or radical Islam seek to impose their way of life on others, champions of liberal democracy have no choice but to go to war on behalf of the ideals they espouse. But those ideals forbid them from coming into conflict with one another. When they happen to have disagreements, as they surely will from time to time, they'll work them out peacefully, as they'd always prefer to if they could trust the other side to be as reasonable as they are. Or so the story goes. Okay, turn to the next slide, where I lay out some of the reasons we should be skeptical of that story. First, we have wars of empire. Even after World War II, a war ostensibly fought in the name of freedom and the right to self-determination, the British and the French fought wars to preserve their empires. In places like Kenya, Indonesia, and Malaysia, in the case of the UK, and Morocco, Algeria, and what was then called Indochina, in the case of the French. Admittedly, not all of these conflicts were fought against independence movements. Some, perhaps, ought not to be classified as wars of empire in the strictest sense. But others pretty clearly are. And whether you want to argue with me about the exact reasons that some of these wars were fought, it's pretty hard to deny that the British and the French were none too eager to recognize the right to self-determination in these places. Now, you might point out that the period of decolonization was a long time ago, that even the most conservative Tory today accepts that the sun has indeed set on the British Empire. Fine, true enough. So let's consider other behaviors that suggest democratic leaders aren't so terribly committed to the lofty ideals they pay lip service to. Consider, for example, the current treatment of racial, ethnic, religious, linguistic, political, and sexual minorities. Great progress has been made in many of these domains, but there's still a long way to go. Enough that it's hard to say with a straight face that democratic societies instill in their citizens a conviction that one must always seek compromises that respect everyone's basic rights. Many in the US and the UK view all Muslims as terrorists, or at least potential terrorists. Black people in the US are assaulted or even killed by the police for no greater crime than allegedly failing to show enough respect. There are politicians in the US who have advocated laws preventing a Muslim from becoming president, who refuse to denounce domestic acts of terrorism when they are committed by white men whose politics are right of center. There's growing concern as well that the left has lost its respect for freedom of expression. Regardless of whether anyone listening to this lecture is, for whatever reason, willing to defend these things, you have to admit that they don't exactly show a deep and abiding respect for the importance of nonviolent resolution of disagreements or for the importance of always respecting certain rights. It's not even clear how many people in democratic states are committed to democracy, at least when it doesn't give them the right outcome. A 2015 poll found that nearly half of UKIP supporters would be okay with a military coup should the government try to scrap the Trident system, pull out of NATO, or shrink the size of the armed forces. Similarly, there have been instances where Israeli religious figures have called on members of the IDF to defy orders handed down by the duly elected government should those orders violate their interpretation of what is in Israel's best interests. Now, I know what you're thinking. These are fringe groups. That doesn't invalidate claims about how governments behave, because no one with views that extreme is ever going to become president or prime minister. But there's two problems with that. One is how often US politicians have expressed the view that some policy at odds with either the Constitution, basic American values, or both, prior to taking office, only to continue and indeed defend that policy once they make it to the White House. To say nothing of Nixon's insistence that any action taken by the president is constitutional simply because it was taken by the president. The other is the fact that Western governments tend to be highly selective, meaning inconsistent, in their perceptions of election outcomes abroad and their reactions to independence movements. That is, even if you think the deeply illiberal politics espoused by some admittedly more extreme groups in the US, the UK, and elsewhere says nothing about whether democratic leaders externalize certain norms, you still have to confront the fact that democratic leaders have themselves rejected those norms on more than one occasion through their actions, if not their words. They have made it clear that their commitment to the values we're supposed to believe they hold dear is actually quite tenuous. Should those values come into conflict with their short-run interests, the latter often win out. Never mind all the hypocrisies of the Cold War, when the U.S. overthrew, or helped to overthrow, democratically elected governments whose politics were just a little too far left. I know that won't impress many of you, because in your minds, the Cold War belongs to the same way back when category as World War II, and probably even the American Revolution. What I'm about to describe is similar, and probably is best viewed as a continuation of a larger trend, but whatever. Consider the People's Mujahideen of Iran, also known as the MEK. This is a leftist revolutionary group that has denounced U.S. imperialism and was once allied with Saddam Hussein's regime. They've also committed many acts of terrorism, and were accordingly once recognized as a terrorist group by the U.S. government. But that designation was removed in 2012. Some will tell you that's because they've since renounced violence. And they have, formally. But so have other groups that are still on the U.S. State Department's list of terrorist organizations or state sponsors of terror. And it's probably no coincidence that around the same time, they were widely believed to have conducted acts of sabotage and targeted violence, many of which meet certain definitions of terrorism, against scientists working for Iran's nuclear program, or that they're believed to have done so with Israeli and American help. In other words, the U.S. opposes terrorism unless it's done by people who hate the right people, in which case the U.S. government will pretend it's not terrorism and perhaps even support it. We could also talk about the fact that the U.S., the U.K., and other democratic states support some of the worst violators of human rights and suspected supporters of terrorism, provided that they happen to support Western foreign policy, like Saudi Arabia. Or how the U.S. and the U.K. supported some of the Arab uprisings while ignoring others and quietly helping to crush the one in Bahrain. But by now, you're either persuaded or refuse to be, so I think we should move on. To sum up, if we assume that losing wars is politically disastrous for democratic leaders, but not autocratic ones, and or that these leaders hold certain norms very dear, yes, that would explain why there are so few wars between democracies. But a lot of the other things that would logically need to be true, according to those arguments, aren't. And some of the things that would need to not be true are. That's a problem. A rather big one. Perhaps you take issue with some of the specific claims I've made along the way. That's fine. I know a lot of what I've said in this lecture is controversial. But if you want to argue that there's something about democratic governance that directly prevents wars between democracies, you need to tell me why I should believe that autocratic leaders aren't worried about losing wars when doing so, dramatically increases the odds of them losing their lives. And why I shouldn't be concerned that democratic leaders so often set aside their cherished principles when they stand in the way of achieving other interests. If it wasn't already clear, I'm not saying that they shouldn't do so. If you believe that, in the realm of international relations, might makes right, and governments should do what must be done to promote their interests, even if that means setting aside certain principles they try to live up to domestically, good for you. If you don't believe that, that's cool too. I'm not here to change anyone's values. I'm here to help you make sense of broad patterns that repeat themselves time and again in international relations. The argument I'm making isn't that the US, the UK, or democracies in general are terrible hypocrites who are responsible for all that's wrong in the world. I realize it might sound that way to some of you, because there are those who do make such claims, and they point to some of the same sorts of examples I used above. But all I'm saying is that we have lots and lots of evidence that democratic leaders are willing, at times, to set aside their values in order to advance their interests. And as long as that's true, we ought to be skeptical of the claim that the reason democracies so rarely fight one another, if they ever have at all, is because their respect for those values is so unwavering that they couldn't even countenance going to war against a fellow democracy. There's every reason to believe that they could. The basic problem here is that there's no shortage of explanations for why the US and the UK haven't fought a war against one another since 1812, or that France and Germany haven't done so since 1945. If we say that joint democracy promotes peace, we're saying that an Egyptian government that was more responsive to public opinion would be less likely to abandon the 1979 peace treaty with Israel. There are people who believe that, but I've got my doubts. One big problem with both causal interpretations of the correlation between joint democracy and peace is that they tell us that democracies handle their disagreements differently. Neither of the arguments I've just taken you through said that democracies will always get along with one another, just that either self-interest or commitment to liberal values will prevent them from fighting when they do. The problem is, as of this moment in history, we have almost no examples of democratic states having serious disagreements with one another, but choosing to resolve them differently than any other pair of states with an equally intense disagreement would. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Here's an alternative explanation. What if countries only transition to democracy and remain there once they've done so, if they find themselves in a hospitable environment? That is, one might argue that when there are serious threats from neighboring states, it's easier for the government to get away with consolidating power, delaying elections, perhaps indefinitely, suspending civil liberties, and placing strong limitations on freedom of the press. Consider, for example, the end of the Roman Republic, which gave way to the not-so-democratic Roman Empire. How did that happen? Well, in the midst of war, the Senate appointed Julius Caesar dictator for life so that he could better protect Rome from her enemies. Similarly, Pakistan was, by most definitions, democratic in the years following independence. But in 1958, there was a military coup, executed by a general who feared that the president wasn't doing enough to protect Pakistan from the threat posed by India. Yes, the state of the economy and other factors heavily contributed to the coup, but it's no coincidence that one of the first major goals the new president set was relocating the capital from Karachi, which is closer to the border with India, to Islamabad, which is a little bit further away and more defensible. In other words, proponents of the democratic peace would have us believe that India and Pakistan have fought several wars between 1947 and 1999 because only one of them is democratic. I'd argue that the reason only one of them was democratic through most of that period was that they'd yet to resolve long-standing territorial disagreements, which is also why they fought several wars. Is that just an isolated example? I don't think so. Turn to the fourth slide. There, I describe the data I used to demonstrate that the apparent association between joint democracy and peace is really driven by the absence of territorial disagreements. This is the same data set I've used in a few lectures now. It covers the same time period and has the same dependent variable. But I've now added two new independent variables. One tells us whether both states in the dyad were considered democratic that year by the Polity Project, which puts out one of the most commonly used measures of regime type. You can find more information about Polity online if you're interested. And the other tells us whether one state laid claim to territory possessed by the other state, as indicated by the issue correlates of war dataset, which can also be found online. Now turn to the fifth and final slide. Here, you see a table of results, not unlike others you've seen in this module. There are two columns, because I performed two sets of analysis. In one, I included a measure of how costly the war would be and whether both sides were democratic, but nothing else. In the other, I included those two variables, as well as the one that tells us whether the two states have a territorial disagreement, as indicated by one laying claim to territory currently held by the other. And while the inclusion of that variable has no effect on our estimate of the relationship between the costs of war and the likelihood of it occurring, in both cases, the results tell us that there's a negative and statistically significant relationship between how costly war would be if it were to occur and whether it actually did. The same cannot be said of joint democracy. That variable is found to have a negative and statistically significant association with war in the first model, but not in the second. Unsurprisingly, territorial disagreements are positively associated with the occurrence of war. In other words, if we look at interactions between all pairs of states from 1816 to 2007, except for the roughly 30-year period involving the world wars, we find that wars occur less often between pairs of democracies. But it seems that this is only true because so few democracies have territorial disagreements with one another, not because joint democracy itself promotes peace.